the call. We are going to give everyone a few more minutes to hop on and join us, but I want to make sure that the technology is working. So if you're on the website, you should see a button that says raise hand. Raise your hand so we know that you can hear this. And if you're on the phone, press star 2, and that'll communicate the same information. Okay, great. Seeing some hands. Okay, terrific. Well, we're going to give everyone a second to get on the call, so sit tight for just a few more minutes, and we will begin the call. Okay, well, we're going to get started. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today on this Sunday. It's great to be with you. I'm excited to hear from you and answer your questions. We've received a number of great questions already over the past few weeks. And my associate, John Uzzini, is also on the call with us today. He's collected them. We're going to be answering them in short order. If you haven't had a chance to send us your question, or if you think of a question today during our call, simply raise your hand. And we will call on you, or press star 2, that'll communicate the same information. Is there a question already? I'm going to assume that's a mistake, and we'll come back to that later on if that hand is still up. So before we get to the question and answer section of today's program, I want to begin by thanking all of you for being part of this. If you're on this call, you purchased an all-access pass to the summit, and your purchase helped make the summit possible, not just for you, but for everyone else. This is an event that took 7 months of work to prepare, and a lot of smart people worked very hard to make it possible. We had a team of researchers and editors. I know it was just me on the screen, but we had a team of researchers, editors, transcriptionists, designers, art directors, web programmers. It was truly a robust operation comprised of both people who were passionate to get the insights out there, but also people we hired on a contract basis. And your generosity really made this possible. So thank you very much for supporting this. I can't say enough about how encouraged and energized I've been by the response. Let me tell you a little bit about what was happening behind the scenes, both before and during the summit, just to give you a little bit of context. We knew we had thousands of proven scientific insights that were out there that could help people be more productive at work. We also knew we had a stellar panel of charismatic experts who can help deliver that information. What we didn't know, running a web-based conference, was whether anyone would show up to hear it. And so, as you can imagine, 7 months of work, no registrants, it was quite a gamble. But thankfully, what we experienced was complete validation that this enterprise was worth embarking upon, and not just because of the appetite for the program, but because of the enthusiasm and the passion of the participants who were taking part in this. It was truly infectious. And one of the kind of the regrets I have for this program was if you purchased an all-access pass, you stopped receiving the emails. And so you weren't going to the daily posts of the videos and the comments that were being posted. And so you didn't get to see the 30 or so comments on Dan Pink's talk and the 50 comments on Susan Pierce Thompson's talk. And so it was really energizing to see that. And people were just really passionate about what they were hearing and talking about how they were applying the insights. It was really kind of infectious. And the magnitude truly was extraordinary. Overall, you know, you've heard some of this, but overall, more than 35,000 people attended the summit, people from all over the globe, and the videos were watched over 114,000 times. So perhaps more important, you know, it wasn't just the sheer number of people, but the diversity of the audience members was truly impressive. So we had participants in the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, Italy, the United Kingdom, Russia, Norway, Israel, Nigeria, India, and many more countries. And, you know, it was also the range of people who were being who were participating, not just, you know, the people all over the globe, but also we saw people from different professions and experience levels. We heard from employees and managers. We heard from CEOs and students. We heard from retirees and stay-at-home parents. And so the material really struck a chord. And in retrospect, I guess that should be no surprise. I mean, after all, no matter where you are in life, you can benefit from having more focus, from experiencing more energy, and from being more effective. Then, as the number of audience grew, the number of attendees grew, we started getting media attention. And so the media picked up on the event, and that fueled even more people coming. There were stories in CNN, Harvard Business Review, Inc., Psychology Today, Gannett, Business Insider, Lifehacker. And we started receiving requests from reporters for the transcript so that they could write about the insights that our experts were reporting. One reporter emailed me last week to say she expects to write another 4 stories on this in Business Insiders just to cover all the tips she picked up from the transcripts. Another surprise was that we started getting unsolicited requests from speakers who wanted to present. They wanted to be interviewed. And so these are highly respected authors, researchers, professional speakers, people who get tens of thousands of dollars to give presentations, asking to see if they could be part of the program for free just so they could reach so many people. So it was really amazing to see that happen. And in fact, we received so many requests from speakers and so many emails from people who either found out about the summit while it was going on or towards the end or missed it entirely that there's already been talk about organizing a second Peak Work Performance Summit. And so that's really gratifying for going from having no registrants to having 35,000 and perhaps another summit in the works. I could tell you on a personal level for me, this was my first foray into the online world. So for the past couple of years, I've been writing for the Harvard Business Review and CNN, and I wrote a book, and all that's been impactful. But what I saw here really opened my eyes to the possibilities of new ways in which we can deliver some of these practical insights to people on a whole new level. Over the last few years, we've really seen unprecedented advances in the technology that connects all of us. And I've been really inspired by what I saw here in terms of the shared interest, the engagement, and perhaps most importantly, the community that this program helped inspire in just a short span of a week. And I'm now seriously giving thought to developing additional programs that can help people be more effective in a variety of different spheres of their life. Everything from becoming more proactive at work, like the summit, to navigating challenges when life gets hectic, to thriving at home so we can be more true to ourselves and more present for our loved ones. We're still really in the early phases, but I'm looking forward to sharing more soon and perhaps even asking you for some of your input so that we can co-create some of these programs together. So thank you very much for helping me recognize that possibility and for being part of what is fast becoming a community of smart, ambitious, like-minded people who are ready for a more intelligent way to work. So before we get to the question and answer portion of today's call, I want to quickly mention for those of you who didn't know that we added a number of additional interviews to the summit program that weren't originally programmed. So as I mentioned, if you purchased the summit early on, you were taken off the email list, and so you didn't know that we added 2 additional days. But you get access to all of those interviews on the summit package. If you go to the summit website, you'll see that we extended the summit by 2 days, and now we have additional experts that you can watch. And I have to tell you, some of those interviews ended up being some of the best we had all summit. So initially, there were supposed to be 26 interviews. I think we're up to 32 now. And to give you a feel for some of the highlights, you'll hear on those interviews from people like behavioral economics expert and Duke professor Dan Ariely, who tells us how we can get more sleep by buying 2 flavors of toothpaste. This was probably one of my favorite insights in the summit. You'll hear him talk about how we have associations with the flavor of toothpaste that we use in the morning. And so if you can establish a different association with the toothpaste you used at night, then that'll help you fall asleep because it programs your body in a sense. Now it's time to wind down and get some rest. Then there's Carrie Wilkerson, who offers her suggestions for starting a business while keeping your day job. She talks about how job security is really a myth and how we need to face that myth head on and what we can do to position ourselves to succeed. And then there's Hal Elrod, who gave some really fantastic tips about getting up early in the morning and getting your day off to the right start. So if you haven't sampled any of those, I think you're in for a treat. They're definitely worth checking out. Okay, so let's move on to the question and answer portion. So as a reminder, if you have a question you'd like me to address, click on raise hand. Or if you would, if you're using a phone, press star 2. So let me turn it over to John. We'll start with a question we received before today's call.
Thanks, Ron. Our first question comes from Phil in Los Angeles. And Phil writes, I have two young children, and the only time I see them during the week is when I get home from work. The commute's not easy, so most nights I only get about an hour with them before their bedtime. I want to make the most of that time, but I find myself checking my phone throughout the hour, and then it's over before I know it. What should I do differently?
Well, I love this question because I think it highlights a struggle that we can all relate to, which is that we have, you know, whether you have children or not, which managing technology is difficult. And we need to create situations or position ourselves by shaping our environment by preventing technology from really managing us. So we now have access to a variety of tools that are designed to be used compulsively. The internet is designed to be used compulsively. iPads are designed to be used compulsively. And of course, our smartphones are designed to be used compulsively. Your smartphone wants to be looked at. The more you look at your smartphone, the more opportunities there are for companies to market to you. And so that makes companies more profitable. So, you know, that's why I think it's really critical that we prevent our technology from managing us. And, you know, that's why you have phones that are programmed to have text that are popping up all the time, alerts, vibrations. The challenge is you can't look at your smartphone and be present at the same time. It's simply not possible. So I'm going to give you a few suggestions. And I had the benefit of seeing this question in advance. I got to give it a little bit of thought. One of the obvious suggestions is to silence your phone and put it on airplane mode when you arrive home for that first hour so that you're not interrupted. But in all likelihood, that won't be enough. And the reason that won't be enough is because it's not just your phone interrupting you, but you actually actively seeking distractions from your phone. Especially if you spend all day responding to information, your brain becomes primed to seek out novel experiences. And so if you're in that mode of constantly seeking out novel experiences, it's really difficult to transition back to an environment where there just isn't that much stimulation. So rather than simply turning the phone off, I would urge you to actually physically separate yourself from your phone, put it in a different room. That makes it harder to check, right? Because then you have to go and find your phone, pick it up and look at it, either put it in a different room, stow it in your briefcase, leave it in your car when you get home and only take the phone after the hour spent with your children. You'll probably still feel that need for distraction, but when the phone is harder to reach, it's harder to satisfy that urge, making you more present in that moment. A third suggestion I have is perhaps the best thing you can do is provide some structure for yourself during that hour. So rather than making your goal not to be distracted for that 1 hour, give yourself a positive goal of playing a game or reading a book to your children. When we have a goal that gives us something to move forward toward, something desirable that we're trying to find in our lives, that makes it a lot easier to stay focused than when we're trying to move away from a negative outcome. So again, rather than making your focus on how do I not be distracted, make your focus how do I stay present in a particular activity. So thank you for that. And I'm going to turn it over to John again for the next question.
Okay, Ron, I think our next question, I think we have a caller with her hand up. I think Marina in New York City has a question. Marina, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, can you tell us your question?
Yes, I was wondering, we know so much now from your work about what makes a great workplace, but I was wondering, what do you do when you have a boss, for example, that really isn't interested in what makes a great workplace or is resistant to changing anything?
I really love that question, and I actually get it a lot when I give talks about the best place to work. And it's how do I get my manager to buy into some of these ideas? And I have to tell you, let me just start off by telling you what you shouldn't do. And what you shouldn't do is give them the book and say, here, you should read this book. Because that's the equivalent of handing your spouse a book on how to be a better husband, or worse, how to lose some weight. So anytime you give someone a how-to book, you're communicating an implicit criticism. And in this case, it's one about one that can damage your career in some pretty concrete ways. So here's how you do it instead. And that is to start a book club at work. Now, I recognize that there might be some challenges here, so hear me out for a second. Tell your boss you'd like to start a lunchtime discussion group to help you and your colleagues think about new ideas. Chances are your manager is not going to say, that's a terrible idea. I don't want anyone to be learning new things at the office. Chances are they're going to like that idea. You're going to position yourself as being kind of a proactive person. And one company I know has a you don't need to read the book club, and it's a great incentive. It's something that tells people you don't have to read this book to come and join us during our lunch meeting, but here we can have this discussion group. One person, we're going to rotate. One person is going to be in charge of sharing some of the insights that they picked up, and then we're just going to have a discussion around it. It becomes a very kind of a social gathering. So that way it doesn't feel like a homework assignment, and then ask your manager if he or she would be willing to stop by, and chances are they'll say yes, they'll thank you for taking the initiative, and you use the book club to discuss ideas that will help improve your workplace. So this way the suggestions aren't coming from you. It's not Marina saying, you know, hey, can we do the following to improve the way we communicate? Maybe we should abolish performance reviews, should do this instead. Rather, the ideas are coming from the book, and so you're the one who's helping to bring the ideas forward, and you're no longer in the forefront. Alternatively, if you don't think reading a book is going to fly with your colleagues, you can suggest a TED talk once a month. And there are some great TED Talks on workplaces. Dan Ariely has a great one. Dan Pink has a great one. That's another tool you can use to get the discussion going. And, you know, most important, though, as you do this, is just try to create an agenda for what happens during that lunch hour meeting. So you don't want it to be a free-for-all. You want the first part to be about introducing the ideas, maybe have a second part that's open for discussion. But the critical piece is the third part, and that is where you try to transition the discussion to applications. And you ask a question like, how might we apply some of these ideas to our company? And I bet you'll start seeing some changes in short order. And the nice thing is you're going to receive a lot of the credit from management and colleagues alike. Okay, John, who's next?
Okay, well, this was a question that we got through the website. This is from Melissa in Utah. Melissa writes, how do I better address phone call emergencies? My boss asks that we answer calls when they come in as much as possible during business hours. Every phone call seems to be an emergency, and I have to leave what I was working on to address it. I feel my most productive time is after hours, but I don't want to work after hours. I have felt that there must be a better way, but I can't seem to find one that keeps my boss and clients happy.
Yeah, I think this is a constant challenge for many of us. And, you know, our most satisfying work comes when we're working on projects that we ourselves initiate. Hearing a little bit of feedback. John? Okay, great. Thank you. So what I was saying in addressing the question here from Melissa is that this is a constant challenge for all of us. Our more satisfying work comes when we're playing offense, when we're moving the ball forward on proactively on project that we ourselves initiate. The trouble is that most of us are in roles that require us to be responsive either to managers or to clients who want answers immediately. And so what ends up happening is if you want to feel productive, you have to either come in early, stay late, or work on the weekend, and that's just not a recipe for success, at least not one that is sustainable. So you can do it in the short term. You can come in early, you can stay late, you can work over the weekends. But if you're doing that constantly, what's going to happen is you're going to feel burnt out, and that's going to undermine your interest in your job and hurt your performance. So here's some suggestions that I would offer, Melissa. One is to test the boundaries. And here's what I mean by that. So it seems from the way that the question was phrased, which is that I need to be on point for my clients and for my manager, that Melissa feels that she's working from the assumption that if she's not being immediately responsive, her boss or her clients are going to react negatively. And I would urge you, Melissa, to test that assumption. In other words, for one day, try an experiment. Challenge yourself to turn your email alerts off for 25-minute periods. Set your alarm for 25 minutes, and for 25 minutes, work uninterrupted, not paying attention to any emails. Then at minute 25, turn on your email, check all the messages you got, respond as needed. Do this for the entire morning and see if anyone notices. If it works, extend the 25-minute test periods over to the entire day and see what happens. I think that what you'll find is at the end of the day, you'll find that you got a lot more done and no one had an emergency that couldn't be resolved without your attention for 25 minutes. And I think if that you see that that's working for you, you can expand those 25-minute trials to maybe 35 minutes, 45 minutes, maybe even 60 minutes. Another idea, beyond just some things that you can do yourself, is to talk to your colleagues and see if this is a challenge that they also face. And my sense is if you're finding it a challenge, probably your colleagues are as well. And if you're all experiencing this, what you might consider is taking turns being on call for your clients. In other words, rotate with a group of select colleagues, have someone on point one day a week for responding to emails that are coming in. And obviously there are going to be some technological issues that you're going to have to think about ways of making this practical, like how do we get all the emails going to the right inbox, but they're solvable problems. These are not things that are insurmountable. And what it does is it allows people, if you're not, you know, you have the one day where you're responding to emails in the mornings, and then you have 4 days of the week, as if you've got a group of five people, 4 days of the week when you're attending to your work in an uninterrupted fashion. And I think that's a nice way of resolving the conflict where you have one person who's on point and giving responses to clients immediately, but four people who feel like they're being more productive. The third idea is to go to your manager and to suggest what Todd Henry in his interview called a no-fly zone, which a number of companies have been experimenting with, which is you have an agreement or an expectation that between certain hours, people are not expected to respond to emails. And you can try, for example, between the hours of 10 and 12 in the morning. For 10 and 12, if you have an emergency, boss, you pick up your phone and you call me. Otherwise, I'm going to look at my email at 12 o'clock. And obviously that's not something you can try on your own tomorrow. It's something that requires a level of buy-in from your manager. But all of these are things to try. And I have to tell you, I empathize with the situation. I was in positions where you were expected to be responsive constantly, and it's just not a method of working that's conducive to being productive. So I want to remind people that if you're on the phone, you can ask a question by by using star two, or if you're on the webcast, you can just click on raise hands, and we will be happy to call on you. John.
All right. Well, the next question is one we've actually received from a couple of different people on the list, and so since there's some commonality around this question, we wanted to make sure we addressed it. So, Ron, how do you maintain a high level of performance when you're unemployed?
This is a great question, and I was surprised by the number of people who participated in the summit who asked this question because, you know, you just kind of assume as you're putting this together, you're focused on people who are working in the workplace. But obviously this is something that is a common experience for a lot of us, regardless of how successful or high performing we are. We're going to experience periods when we're not employed. And so I would say a couple of things, and one is to you can apply a lot of these insights to the way that you work in some ways more effectively when you're not in a job because you're not required to meet someone else's schedule. So when you're working on your own, you have the independence to really leverage your best hours. And this was a common theme that we had throughout the discussions is that our productivity varies over the course of the day. We tend to be more productive in the mornings, we tend to be less productive in the afternoons, and you have the ability when you're either working for yourself as an entrepreneur or if you're unemployed to make up your schedule that comports to your biological needs and to the way you're able to focus over different periods of the day. So you have some of the benefits of not working for a manager. What we know, again, the research is that in the mornings you can probably be more productive. So if you're unemployed, you can use that time to craft some of your cover letters and to reach out to prospective employers. And then in the afternoon, when your energy dips, you can do some of the things that require less effort, like identifying leads that you can contact the next day. So that's one way of applying the insights. The other suggestion I would make is, and this comes from the book, is that is we have psychological needs that we all have, regardless of how old we are, where we live, where we were born, what culture we were raised in. And those psychological needs are the need for autonomy, so feeling like we're in control of the work that we're doing, having a need for competence, feeling like we're good at what we do, and having a need for connections, feeling like we're connecting to the people around us. Two of those take a really big hit when you don't have a job. The first one is competence, and the second one is relatedness. So you have to work towards finding a job, but you have to do so while honoring those psychological needs. Otherwise, you're just not going to be effective. So let's talk about relatedness first. Relatedness is the need to feel connected to the people around you. And if you have just lost your job, in many cases, you've just lost people you were very, very close with on a regular basis, who you relied on for some of those, for meeting those some of those social needs. And so I would encourage you to identify a social network that can support you during the workday. Loneliness is an energy killer. So if you feel lonely, you might not be consciously aware of it, but it depletes your energy. And so what you want to do is you want to combat that loneliness by making time to meet with people for coffee or for lunch, even if they can't help you find a job. It's not just all about finding a job. You have to make sure that you're really sustaining your energy. And having close, meaningful relationships with people might not feel productive in the moment, but it can help boost your energy level over the course of the day. And frankly, the same can be said for exercise. And the third suggestion is now hitting on competence. Use your afternoons when you're tired, when you can't be quite as effective at doing some of the things that are going to help you find a job. You can use that to build your competence and acquire new skills. Set aside several hours over the course of the day for learning new things. Now, that's going to do a couple of things. One is if you're learning things that can help build your skills and make you more viable as an option as an employee for a number of places, that's useful. But more importantly, the act of learning is psychologically rewarding, and that puts you in a good mood. It rewards you and makes you feel more interested in everything that you do. And so you need to constantly be learning and acquiring new skills in a way that lifts your mood and makes you more effective along the way. So those are the three things. Really leverage your best hours. Make sure you're taking care of your close personal connections and feeling like you are having meaningful relationships throughout the day, and build your competence, not just to make you a more attractive employee, but simply to put you in a better mood and raise your energy level.
Thanks, Ron. Our next question was submitted through the website, and I think it touches on Greg McEwen, who was one of the early speakers on the summit. So our writer says, I like the idea of essentialism. So I'm wondering, are there any additional principles for when I need to perform well in different areas? For example, I'm currently working as an individual contributor at work, but I'd like to take on more managerial responsibilities as well. Our company is still small enough that a manager also needs to do individual contributor work, and I believe it's crucial that I need to be able to handle both responsibilities well, not sacrificing one for the other.
So the question here, and John, maybe you can help me. the question here is, how do I do more management while maintaining my abilities as an employee?
Yes, I would say that is. And just to clarify, this person who wrote in is currently working as an individual contributor, but aspires to take on managerial responsibilities as well. But I think that she or he is anticipating that once they do that, they will still need to be able to handle their individual contributor level responsibilities at the same time.
So that's interesting because the questioner raised the idea of essentialism, and essentialism is about maintaining your focus on very few things so that you can be more impactful in them. But I guess the thing that you want to be most impactful at is developing managerial experiences that applies here. And I think I'm reminded of something that Dan Pink said during his session, which is about job crafting. And so all of the research shows that the people who are happiest at their jobs and people who feel the most autonomous in their jobs are the ones who are taking on new responsibilities, doing them, and feeling them out to see if the ones that they like, and then actually moving proactively in the direction that they want to go. So the default for many of us is that we get a job description and we assume this is what we have to do in order to be successful at this role, and we don't think that it's our job to figure out what it is we need to do next. And that's the mindset that we need to change if we want to feel more autonomous at work. And so in this case, what I would encourage this individual to do is, rather than thinking about managerial experiences more broadly, to take some time to think about what aspects of management he or she enjoys most, and then to identify a few activities that fall within each bucket. So again, I would urge this person, rather than thinking about management as a holistic thing that here's, this is the thing that I'm trying to achieve, is move up in over the corporate ladder, but to really kind of think about what are the aspects of management that really resonate, and then identify ways of doing just those activities. So that way you're not taking off too much and biting off more than you can choose.
Thanks, Ron. All right, we have another question here. This person says, I'm interested in streamlining the process to improve focus and to improve happiness for myself and other engineers who I work with. And this person says that she or he is in an infrastructure team, which is working well, but the team is new in a company that's in the middle of growing from a small to a larger size. And so this team is having trouble getting enough priority in terms of what the company is focusing on. It seems that people around the company agree that there is long-term value in investing in things like helping with employee focus and happiness. But the concern seems to be that they don't have a way yet to specifically convey the value of doing this now, as opposed to at some vague point in the future. So the question is, what's the best way to specifically convey in an explicit way to people across the company that there is value to doing this now, to growing this emphasis on employee focus and happiness now, as opposed to leaving this as something that we'll do vaguely in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I have to say that this is where, depending on where, I didn't get a sense for whether this person was a manager or not, but it sounds like this is a perfect opportunity for introducing them to some of the research like that book club that we discussed earlier, because what the research shows is that the benefits are immediate, and they're immediate in a way that are profitable for companies. And so if you develop some of these programs that make people happier and more engaged at work, company as a whole benefits, and it's particularly critical at a time now where the lifespan of an employee really has shrunk compared to what it was in the past. We're now, we all have access to LinkedIn, we have access to Craigslist, we have access to all of these programs that enable us to find jobs very, very easily. And so as a result of that, we no longer have jobs that take us throughout our career. And so if you're not doing some of these things that build for a better workplace, you're at risk of losing some of your highest producing and most talented employees. And so I actually believe, as this person suggested, that it is critical that you do some of these things in the short term, and it's because you're going to see the benefits immediately as well. And so there's two ways of looking at it. It's like, you know, if I do these great things, then positive things will happen. That's one way of viewing it. But I would urge them to frame it differently, which is, what happens if we don't ensure that our employees are satisfied? We don't ensure that they're feeling engaged and feeling like they're challenged on a regular basis. The result, most likely, is that they'll start losing some of their best people. And so there is a tremendous argument for building a great workplace. And it's not simply because you want people to have happy, positive experiences at work, but rather because you want to ensure that you're successful over the long term.
Thanks, Ron. Our next question comes from Doreen in South Lyon. She says, Ron, I heard you interviewed on the Rory Vaden Show podcast in December 2015, and this led me to get your book and then to become part of the Peak Work Performance Summit. She says, there's so much good information in this summit, it totally blows me away. Can you suggest how I might share some of this knowledge with my coworkers? And she says, on a side note, I do belong to a leader book club, and we're reading your book, The Best Place to Work.
Wow, that sounds like we planted that question. Thank you for that question, Dory. I'd hate to sound like a broken record, but I really love this book club idea. I like the idea of sharing information by having TED Talks. I think there's benefits, not just because you're sharing great information with people that can help improve the way they work, but it's the bonding that happens when we have those shared experiences. And we often, you know, we don't think about that as a critical component of what makes for a great workplace. But having those close, meaningful friendships with the people with whom we work not just makes it work more enjoyable, but actually improves our performance at work. And it's for a number of reasons. You know, when we work with the people who we like and respect, we are better able to focus on our work rather than worrying about whether or not we fit in. We're more honest with our feedback with them. We can tell them when they're off on the wrong path. We're more willing to ask for help. All of these great reasons for why close personal relationships are critical at work, and we don't think about them. You know, we give people the training that they need. We give them the computer. We give them a desk. And we say, you know, in terms of friendships, good luck. I hope people like you. And that's just a really not an effective approach, especially if you're looking to keep people engaged. And so if you want people working at your office over an extended period of time, you have to give them not just a good paying job. You have to give them the opportunities to grow their skill set. You have to make sure that they feel autonomous in the work that they're doing, but you also have to ensure that they feel connected to others. Otherwise, they're going to leave and they're going to take all of their skills and all of their experiences to another place. And it's just, I think, a really boneheaded mood, frankly. And I think that there are very key things that we can all do within our workplaces to ensure that people get along more effectively with one another. And I give an example, I think you might have heard this on the Rory Vaden interview. When someone is joining your company, rather than simply introducing them by their CV or their experiences, just talk about a little bit about what they like to do in the evenings and on the weekends and about their family life. And what that does is that creates opportunities for people to realize that they have some shared commonalities with their colleagues. And that gives them an opportunity to bond over specific topics before or after conference calls or by the water cooler. That's how we form those close personal friendships. It's not on, while working together is important, but when we know what we have in common with one another, that's where we form those close friendships.
Thanks, Ron. You know, as I was listening to you talk just then, I was thinking about a conversation you and I had recently where you were talking about the power of having walking meetings. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those, maybe explain what those are, because I was thinking that in addition to those helping with productivity, I think that those help to foster the kinds of connections you were just talking about.
Right. So this is something that we can all do as an individual, on an individual level, which is go out with colleagues on walking meetings, right? It's not something that we often do. We tend to assume that the best way to have a meeting is to get to go into the conference room together. But here's a way of taking those meetings on the road and getting some exercise while you're working. And what happens when you take a walking meeting with someone who you work closely with is that you tend to become even more close to one another. And it's because you're doing something that's away from everyone else. So it's just the two of you or just the three of you or maybe the four of you. And so that strengthens your relationship. But physiologically, what happens when we're walking is our heart rate goes a little higher. And what happens when our heart rate escalates is that we tend to assume we're excited. And so when you're excited in the company of someone else, you tend to like them more because part of you, you know, unless now you, this might not work for you, but it will still work for your colleagues if now you're aware of it. And so that excitement tends to be projected onto the person with whom you're with. And so it's a way of strengthening relationships while getting exercise. And exercise is key because we know from all of the research that exercise makes us smarter and makes us more energized over the course of the workday, raises our mood, makes sure that we're connecting with our colleagues more effectively. And so exercise is really key. So here's a way of getting two for one in one activity.
Thanks, Ron. Okay, well, I've got one more question here. And as I get ready to read this to you, I wonder if there's anyone on the phone who has a question right now that they'd like to ask in real time. Just a reminder that you can raise your hand by pressing *2 on your phone. And to our friends on the webcast, you can type in a question in the box on your screen, and we'll be able to get to it that way. But here's the other question I have, and this comes from Anne in New York. And she says, great summit, Ron. I'm wondering if the summit will be offered semi-annually or yearly. And also, do you have any thoughts on offering a monthly guest interview?
Oh, that's a very kind question. Thank you, Anne. So right now, we are looking at potentially having another summit after Labor Day in September. And I think it will be a combination of probably some of the speakers we had and some new speakers. We're not quite sure who those will be, but I would welcome suggestions from you. So if you would like to suggest a speaker, I think that would be wonderful. I was thinking of potentially putting out some kind of survey where people can suggest additional people who they'd like to have us invite. We'd be happy to do that. I'm not sure about the monthly interviews. It's a really nice idea. I've really enjoyed putting these together, but I have to tell you, this took a lot of work. So I read everyone's work. And so if they've written 10 books, I read the 10 books, and I really tried to pick out the questions that enable people to identify the actionable tips that they've provided. So you may have noticed, you know, if you've read some of the materials of the people who were part of the summit, a lot of the work is that they write about is theoretical. So here are some things that, you know, here's the psychology of X, Y, and Z. And that is not often translated into practical things that people can put to use immediately. And that was the focus here. This was unapologetically actionable. Every moment, every question I had was intended for giving people practical things that they can apply when they stopped watching the video and went off to work the next day. And so it took a great deal of effort, and I really enjoyed it. I'm not sure if I can make that sustainable for me because on the, you know, building on Greg McEwen's essentialism, there's only so much time, and as enjoyable as this was, there are other things that I have promised myself I will do. But I really appreciate the enthusiasm and you asking about that. All right. Are there any other questions? Going once. Going twice. All right. Well, thank you all very much for being part of the summit. I really enjoyed you being part of this. I want to thank you, and I look forward to staying in touch with you and sharing more insights as we continue this journey together, and I hope that you got as much out of this as I did. Thanks again.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference.